The editor of the Israeli, forgive me, daily newspaper Haaretz recently tried an unorthodox experiment in celebration of Hebrew Book Week. He told most of his staff reporters to take a day off and brought in 31 of Israel's most acclaimed authors and poets. He asked them to report the day's news. Dov Olfan is the editor-in-chief of Haaretz. He joins us from Tel Aviv. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Was this just a stunt?
Oh, no, it's a stunt or a gimmick if there is no significance into it. We really tried something, you know. First idea was, what is a newspaper and why is it important these days when everybody is saying that the printed press is really going kaput? Is there significance to a daily newspaper? Is it an important thing? I was looking for an extreme idea, to let the readers beginning to understand the complexity of the daily newspaper and maybe the significance of their attachment to their daily newspaper and their love for it.
I want to share the first line of one of the stories from that day, an article about a drug rehab center for young people. It's written by David Grossman, the great Israeli writer, and the lead begins, English translation obviously, that precious moment when from beneath the stereotype of the addict, the junkie, the face of youth, almost a child, emerges, and something in his gaze beseeches, look at me, notice me. That's quite a lead.
Yes, this is not something I would receive from a reporter. If a reporter was to send a story, a beginning like this, probably the night editor would cut the opening sentence.
Get to the story, get to the story.
And it's mad, and it's not right, because and therefore it was also a lesson for the editors here. Why do we tell our stories always in the same manner? Some are very young people and some are veterans in Haaretz, and they never had an experience like it. The joy of receiving a text written like David Grossman knows how to write, was something very, very emotional.
Anybody do the weather?
Oh, yes. We had a poet. The poet Roni Somek was asked to write the weather of the day. It's really a poem. The weather that day, no surprise, was very hot.
Yeah. June in Israel, yeah.
The regular report read something like, this is a regular summer day. And in Roni Somek's version that we printed, it was, summer is the pencil that is least sharp in the season's pencil case. And so it continued and it ends. Perhaps this year, too, it will be hot in the low-lying spots. We had another success with the Wall Street Report. That was funny because it's always the same. It always says Wall Street ended with so-and-so and so points, and Nasdaq added I don't know how many points, etc., etc. It's a bit boring, really. It's a bit depressing. And we gave it to a postmodernist writer called Avri Herling, and he had 20 minutes to write his own version to the Wall Street Report. Yeah. That was his report. It went like this. Everything's okay. Everything's like usual. Yesterday, trading ended. Everything's okay. The economists went to their homes. The laundry is drying on the lines. And diners are waiting in places.
Oh.
It was a bit surprising for the reader, this one, because some of them really wanted to know what went on in Wall Street.
I would imagine.
But the real answer is everything is okay.
May I ask carefully, did any of your regular and very highly talented reporters have ambivalent thoughts about this experiment?
Well, they were a bit uneasy about it, most of them. The first top journalist I met, he said, it's very well written, but you can see they are not journalists. They cannot replace us, really. I said, well, that was not the idea. He said, yes, yes, but don't get any wrong ideas. Journalism is a trade. They do not know how to do journalism at work. And he's right, of course, but somebody from the writers, he said to me, you should send them home that day with homework, and the homework would be, let them write a poem for this day. That would be the ultimate, really, job trading.
Mr. Alfon, you sound like a good man to work for. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dov Alfon is editor of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I was in New York at the Personal Democracy Forum this week. Top officials from companies that included Twitter, Microsoft, Craigslist, and Google were there to talk about the intersection of technology and politics. Lots of interesting new ideas were percolating, so we invited the founder of the Personal Democracy Forum, Andrew Roche, to talk about some of them. He joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Andrew, what lessons have you absorbed about social media, technology, or anything else for that matter, from events in Iran?
Well, it's very, very clear that it's getting harder and harder for authoritarian governments to quell dissent. And as we see more and more people with cell phones and social networking tools like Facebook and other technological connecting points, we are going to see a larger and larger exposure of the way in which governments interact with their people and how people interact with each other. So even if in the short term we haven't seen technology overthrow a government, as time goes on, it's going to be harder and harder for any authoritarian organization, government, to quell free speech.
How do you think any of these technologies may change the whole notion of what citizenship is?
Well, we as a country always expected that our elected leaders would delve into the details of our government's activities on our behalf and make decisions for us. And while we were very busy in factories or in the fields, toiling every day, but as the industrial age has grown and made more free time available to individuals, and as technology has made information more ubiquitous, it's very clear that we have currently have a broken system where our elected leaders spend 90% of their time keeping themselves in office and very little time digging into the details of making decisions about our country. So in a digital age, citizenry now provides an opportunity for civic engagement to be relevant to people's lives, where their actions and their organizational ability can be put to use for the benefit of the whole.
And do you think that the whole concept of public might be redefined?
Well, as we have a more networked public sphere, it's pretty clear to the country and the world that everyone is connected to each other. And it's time for our government to acknowledge this fact as well. So I'm proposing that we create something called the Public Means Online Act, which would be defined where whatever information the government commits to making public, the standard for public should include freely accessible online. Information cannot be considered public if it is available only inside a government building, during limited hours, or for a fee. Almost all our public sphere is now online, and our information should be there too.
Andrew Roche, founder and publisher of Tech President and the Personal Democracy Forum. Thanks so much.
Pleasure to be here.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Americans keep putting on pounds, at least according to a report released this week from the Trust for America's Health. That study found that nearly two-thirds of states now have adult obesity rates above 25%. But you might want to take those findings and your next meal with a grain of salt. Not good for water retention, by the way, because they're based on a calculation called the Body Mass Index, BMI. Our math guy, Keith Devlin of Stanford University, thinks he's found some faults with the BMI formula. He joins us in our studios this week. Keith, delightful to see you.
Hi, Scott. Nice to be here in person for once.
The body mass index, that's what, height times weight or something?
To calculate the body mass index, you take your weight in pounds and divide it by your height in inches squared, and you multiply the answer by 703. That gives you a number between 1 and 100. That's your body mass index.
703 because...
Oh, because the formula
that's
was...
That's in the tax code.
That's because the formula was originally invented in Belgium. It was based upon measurements in terms of kilos and meters, and you have to convert it to pounds and inches, and the appropriate conversion factor turns out to be 703.
This formula is, I imagine, the source of the old joke, I'm not overweight, I'm just 3 inches too... too short, right?
It actually reminds me of another joke of the man who has his head in the oven and his feet in the refrigerator. On an average, he feels just fine, but of course he's going to be dead very quickly. I would put the BMI in that category of silly statistics that should have been abandoned many years ago.
Well, what's wrong with it? I mean, we should stipulate the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, along with many doctors, use that statistic.
Yeah. And it's gained this kind of aura of authority, which is really bizarre to any of those of us in mathematics when we come to look at it. It's quite bizarre. It goes back to a Belgian mathematician called Quetelet, who early in the 19th century developed it. He's a very good mathematician. He was the mathematician who really helped get off the ground modern statistical social science, making decisions about populations based on figures and hard data. And he found that if you take people's weight divided by the square of their height, you get a mathematical formula that for the entire population does agree with the data that you've got. Now, he was a smart guy. He was very careful to say, all this does is tell you what's happening at the level of society. He explicitly said you cannot apply it to individuals because it could be very, very misleading.
Oh.
And indeed, it is very misleading.
Well, you found some individuals, right?
In fact, if you look at famous athletes and sports people, very often you can find on their fan sites information about their heights and weights. And looking around, I found that the following individuals are all officially classified as overweight: Kobe Bryant, George Clooney, Matt Damon, Johnny Depp, Brad Pitt, Will Smith, and Denzel Washington.
Tubs of lard all.
And let me add Keith Devlin.
Yeah, now, and you cycle like about 900 miles a week or something.
Well, I
right?
cycle close to 200 miles a week. Yeah. My waist is 32 inches. Most people say I look pretty skinny and I should eat more hamburgers.
Yeah.
But I just tip the BMI at just over 25. I'm at 25.1 most of the time. And that's officially just in the overweight category.
Why is this formula so wrong?
It ignores the waist. Now, if you're ignoring someone's waist measurements, you're ignoring the most obvious measurement of obesity. Your grandmother and my grandmother would say, your belt is too big, you need to lose weight. And your grandmother, I think, would be doing a better job than the CDC is doing. The real scientific reason why it gives you the wrong answer is that the body is made up of different materials. In particular, we have bone, we have muscle, and we have fat. Bone is very dense. It's actually twice as dense as fat. Muscle is less dense than bone, but it's still more dense than fat. The BMI actually classifies as overweight the very most fit members of society who exercise and turn their fat into muscle.
So, Mr. Fancy Schmancy Math Guy, you got a better idea?
First of all, on the CDC's own website, they list alternative methods, which admittedly cost a little bit more money because they do involve looking at the body of the individual concerned, taking a caliper to your midriff and measuring how much fat there is there, putting you in a pool of water and measuring your density and so forth. A simpler method, actually, will just be to measure people's waist size.
During the break, Keith, you and I are going to go in and measure our... dunk ourselves into water and measure our bone density or whatever you say.
I've been cutting down on my food all week in case you ask me that.
Keith, thanks very much.
Okay, my pleasure, Scott.
Keith Devlin, our math guy. Joined now in the studio by our friend NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Morning, Juan.
Good morning.
And let's agree as basketball fans to try and avoid those analogies with all due regard to everybody involved. But what's your initial reaction?
On July 4th, Scott, let me say it's a red, white, and blue mystery. Yesterday, the political class in Washington had the phones ringing all over, you know, what's Sarah Palin doing? What's she up to? Why would she quit in the middle of her term? She's got 16 months remaining, and it would seem that that 16-month period would give her a platform to advance her presidential ambitions and to make the case that she is a conservative reformer, that she's someone who can put in place policies, demonstrate leadership, counter all the critics who say she's not ready to be president of the United States. She's removed that platform of her own doing. It doesn't quite make sense. So some people thought it was erratic. I think there's also a sense that it was a rushed press conference. There was really just a spattering of reporters there, a lot of geese in the background. So the thought is, well, maybe she could be running for the Senate in the future. Maybe she's going to become a TV talk show host. One paper is reporting this morning she's been in talks with NBC.
Yeah.
There's also the possibility she just wants to work on her book deal. She already has a book deal in hand. But don't forget, she's been beat up pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, there was just a recent piece in Vanity Fair that was unflattering. David Letterman was making jokes that were viewed as offensive. Maybe she just wants to get out of the spotlight.
I got an email from someone last night who said, you folks in the East Coast media establishment have never understood her, and that's going to make all of your analysis wrong because she just doesn't think the way you do.
Yeah, one thing before we get off of Sarah Palin, which is to say that she promised on Twitter yesterday that there's more information to come.
Oh, my God. We can check that.
Yeah.
Look, I don't want to ask you another question about Mark Sanford, governor of South Carolina. But I do want to ask you about his wife, Jenny,
yes.
Who has established her own profile this week, I think it's safe to say.
Did not appear at the press conference with him, breaking in this tradition of women who, like Tammy Wynette sang, stand by their man. Mm-hmm. And this has generated a lot of interest in Jenny Stanford. It's exactly who she is. Now, she's from Chicago, Scott, yeah. You might want to know. Graduate of Georgetown University in finance, worked as a vice president for acquisitions and mergers at Lazard Frere. So quite an accomplished woman and someone who has her own wealth. Her grandfather, I think, founded the Skill Power Tool Corporation. Mm-hmm. But here is somebody who's been a political advisor to her husband and who, when this news broke about his soulmate being in Argentina while she has four young boys with him, basically said, you know what, in a statement, I've got to be able to look my sons in the eye and maintain my sense of dignity, my sense of right and wrong. And I think this set her apart and also told the governor to get out, you know, take a break. You're not welcome here. I think this is a real contrast to the way political wives have been handling this in the past. And apparently a lot of women thought, you know, she's the hero in this story.
Yeah. Getting away from politics, although it's never far away from politics, U.S. Marines launched a major offensive in Afghanistan this week. Do the public opinion polls suggest that the American public will support a renewed, perhaps long-term effort in Afghanistan?
Americans don't want war, are tired of war, especially after what we've seen take place in Iraq. For the moment, President Obama is advancing this as a necessary war in some parlance, the good war, as opposed to what took place in Iraq. But for the moment, the U.S. population is willing to hang with it. I don't sense it from the poll numbers that they're willing to stay with it for long, though. So mm-hmm. The question is, how persuasive can President Obama be about the need to pursue this, especially with reports coming in the Washington Post this week that some commanders on the ground are going to ask for more troops? You have at the moment about 68,000 authorized. President Obama put an additional 21,000 in earlier this year. What if you need more, Scott? And, you know, the ongoing battles are difficult.
Finally, Michael Jackson news continues unabated this week. There was a tribute to him at the Apollo Theater in New York City. Has his death refreshed his perspective with some Americans?
Well, I think especially in the black community, it's interesting. There's a sense of wanting to be protective of that legacy and celebrating his greatness. But at the same time, you got to remember, Quincy Jones, the great producer who did Thriller with him, said recently, and he said this to Details, it's obvious he didn't want to be black. And that has always been a kind of tension with Michael Jackson. And by the way, I just want to correct something I said last week when I said that he had done Ebony and Ivory. I should have said that with Paul McCartney, he did The Girl Is Mine, which suggested his interest in kind of crossing racial barriers and becoming a pop icon for all segments. But yeah, I think there is a reassessment going on about Michael Jackson and a celebration of the tremendous music that he brought and his genius as opposed to all the scandals.
Thanks very much, NPR News analyst Juan Williams.
You're welcome, Scott.
Now we're going to check on that other great sporting event that's just across the channel. Another showdown today over strawberries and cream. It's Williams versus Williams for the fourth time in a decade at Center Court in Wimbledon. We're joined now by our sports guy, Howard Bryant. Howard, morning. How are you?
Good morning, Scott.
An all-Williams final at Wimbledon again. Venus Williams playing for her sixth title, Serena for her third. What an extraordinary rivalry this has become.
It's a great rivalry. I mean, they've played 20 times, and they're 10 wins and 10 losses apiece. I love it, actually. I think that for the sport, I think it's great. I like both of their styles, especially the fact that Serena is so good at the Australian Open and Venus is so good at Wimbledon, yet they seem to meet each other everywhere.
Mm. There are people who say they're just getting a little tired of it.
Yeah, and I don't understand those people. Obviously, they could run for the role of NFL commissioner because they like parity. I'm not a parity person. I like dominance. I like names to run the sport. I like to see the best of the best performing at a high level. And let's face it, I don't think it hurts the game at all. Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert at 14 times, and people loved it. I think it gives the sport an identity, especially over decades.
And what about the men's final between Roger Federer and whoever the can of corn he'll be playing this year is?
Well, that would be
that's Andy Roddick. He's not a can of corn. But.
Well, but that's the funny thing about Federer. You talk about rivalries. Well, the thing with Federer is that I've lost a lot of enthusiasm for the men this time around because Nadal's not there. It's been pretty much a hammer and nail relationship with Federer and anybody other than Nadal. Mm-hmm. So. That's one of the reasons why I like that rivalry. You want to have somebody there who's going to give the champ a run for his money.
Let me ask you about Manny Ramirez's return to Major League Baseball last night. Played for the Dodgers after 50-game suspension for using banned drugs. Did not get a hit. That'll, I assume, come to an end at some point. He was very popular in the minors. What about the reaction when he comes back to the
And very
bigs?
Popular in the majors. I think the one thing that we've learned over the last 10 or 12 years when it comes to anabolic substances and the so-called steroid era is that steroids are always the other guy's problem. When it's your guy, no harm, no foul. Remember in San Francisco where the Giants fans were completely partisan behind Barry Bonds. It's the same thing in Los Angeles. And I don't think that mitigates the issue and the wrongdoing, but certainly it does make the fan response fairly predictable. When it's your guy, get him on the field and have him win games for us.
Mm. And his return makes the Dodgers even tougher?
They're a good team. They were a good team before. They're an even better team now. They're the best team in the National League, even though I still think the Phillies are going to get it together. Mm-hmm. They're very, very tough, and having him in the lineup always makes you a dangerous club. Mm-hmm.
Yao Ming of the Houston Rockets has a serious foot injury. They're even suggesting it could end his career. What happened?
Yeah, so serious. And that's the peculiar thing about sports. When you saw that injury against the Lakers in the playoffs, it didn't look like it was a career-threatening injury. There was even talk that maybe he might come back for one of the games. And then very, very quickly, it went from day-to-day to surgery to out for the year to possibly having his career finished. He is one of the most popular players in the NBA. He's clearly one of their marketing engines. This would be a devastating blow, especially for their efforts to grow the game internationally. He's gigantic in China.
He's gigantic in Iowa.
He's gigantic everywhere.
Phil Jackson said yesterday he's good to go to return as coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. Won his championship this year, of course, surpassing the Mark Red Auerbach set with the Boston Celtics. Let me put it to you bluntly, my friend. Is Phil Jackson the greatest pro coach ever or the luckiest because he inherited teams with Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and Kobe Bryant?
You could make the argument for both. To me, I give Phil Jackson credit because he had to do it. Did he have the greatest players of all time? Yes. I think Phil Jackson even had better players than Red Auerbach. But then again, Red was playing with a pretty full deck himself.
Yeah.
I think the difference with Phil Jackson is that he had players that were great at any era, but you have to give him credit because these players performed at a high level at all times, and that doesn't always happen. I think one of the hardest things to do is to take all those massive, high-ego, high-talent guys and get them to play together, and he did that. If he didn't do it, you'd say, well, how come Phil Jackson underachieved with those talented players? So I give a guy credit for getting those guys to play, especially in the NBA where the player has so much more control over the coach. He's one of the few guys who can get these multi-million dollar players' attention.
Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, thanks so much.
My pleasure.